Hello, and welcome to the Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness podcast. I'm your host today, Inman Narrowin, and I use they, them pronouns. Today we have a really fun story from Margaret Killjoy, who's also a Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness person, collective member. And we have a story for you today called A Field, a Shadow, Indeed a Shadow. And it's about two teenagers discovering what it means to wander the woods, the night, and to take action in all of the small ways that feel big, to save their forest from destruction, and to answer the call to adventure. The word of the month is a word that's meant to be mean, but holds great power. Can you guess what it is? As always, our story is read by the incredible Bee Flowers, and you can read along for free at tangledwilderness.org, or you can sign up for our Zine of the Month Club to get a physical version of the story sent to you every month. Enjoy.
A Field, a Shadow, Indeed a Shadow. Written by Margaret Killjoy and narrated by Bee Flowers. Margaret Killjoy, she, they, is a trans feminine author and musician living in the Appalachian Mountains with her dog. She is the author of A Country of Ghosts as well as the Danielle Kane series of novellas. She plays piano, synth, and harp in the feminist black metal band Feminazgul, and she is the host of the community and individual preparedness podcast Live Like the World is Dying and the history podcast Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff. The thing about being the weird girls is everyone just kind of lets you get away with weird shit. Up to a point. Usually that point hovers somewhere around felony, which meant that I was about to get us into trouble. Someone had torn down our fort. Okay, they'd torn down the forest around it too, and I suppose in a cosmic sense, that was the bigger deal. But I hadn't spent half my 18 years laboriously building the fucking forest. They'd clear-cut the whole thing. Or at least several acres of it. I have no idea how big an acre is, really. I can't picture it. They'd fucked up a lot of forest. Like a whole neighborhood's worth of forest, all gone. Nothing left but dust and dirt and branches and the ruins of our fort. It hadn't even been personal. They'd done it with bulldozers. No one had scaled the, admittedly precarious, flagpole and torn down our rainbow flag. No one had gone through the effort to graffiti some hate crime shit calling us queers. Hell, no one had even bothered to rob us. Nick had spent hours and hours and broken not a small number of laws assembling the solar setup, and no one had bothered to steal the panels she'd rightfully stolen in the first place. They were just smashed and scattered. No one had come in like Goldilocks and eaten our porridge either. Okay, we hadn't had any porridge, but we'd had a pretty sizable stash of potato chips, those kettle-cooked ones. Every single bag of those things was just right, but a bulldozer doesn't give a shit about that. But we'd had a pretty sizable stash of potato chips, those kettle-cooked ones. Every single bag of those things was just right, but a bulldozer doesn't give a shit about that. They hadn't slept in our chairs or watched our TV or found Nick's stash of gay porn or my stash of gay porn or done anything that any reasonable intruder would have done. They'd just fucking bulldozed it. All of it. Smoosh. Gone. Goodbye, Fort Gay Gay, which still needed a better name if you ask me. But Nick thought it was funny and that girl never thought anything was funny, so I let her have it. Fort Gay Gay would have gone to ruin soon, regardless, of course. I was off to Evergreen in the fall, and Nick was... She wasn't sure what she was going to do. She'd gotten into every school she'd applied to, and then turned them all down. She had a ticket to New Zealand and some money saved up, and that was enough for her. But that wasn't how the end of the fort should have gone. It wasn't right. "We gotta make them pay for this," I told Nick. She tossed back her cloak, drew her sword, and held it aloft in the sun. By this blade, hand-forged by an underpaid craftsman in India, and purchased by me at the Oregon Renaissance Fair, I swear we will have our vengeance, she said. She liked being dramatic. Yeah, I said. We'll fuck them up. I liked being direct. Neither of us much liked thinking about consequences, but who does? Even still, we can't trash a bunch of bulldozers in broad daylight. We slouched off in the trees, back from whence we'd come. Nick's parents always let her out at night to see me because they were afraid she'd wind up gay and figured it was good for her to hang out with girls. Which is to say, Nick is trans, but her parents don't know it yet. They still think she's their son. Nick definitely is very straight because, oh my lord, all she ever talks about is boys. She won't shut up. But I guess that's also kind of gay, even though she's a woman. I don't know. Sometimes she calls herself gay and sometimes she calls herself straight. I know she only likes boys, which of course doesn't do me any good, but I got over that a long time ago. And around her parents, she calls herself a boy, and at school, she doesn't call herself anything. She just scowls at everyone, and they leave her alone. You think the trench coat kids are good at scaring the normie kids? Wait till you see the cloak kids. Just the one. Wait till you see Nick. People take one look at her and assume she has vials of poison under her cloak. She doesn't. Or a stash of bizarre homemade weapons in the woods near her house. She does. Mainly, though, no one messes with her because even some of the popular kids kind of like her, even though they're scared of her. It ain't the 90s anymore. Also, she helps everyone with their homework. Nick is so complicated. Not me. I'm a simple girl, born a girl, likes other girls. Not Nick. I swear, I'm over that. I like chewing bubblegum, and I like listening to bubblegum, and I like Lisa Frank dolphins and shit, ironically, but also unironically, and I like vengeance. Just like any girl. I call myself James, too, but only around Nick. Everyone else can call me Jamie. I don't think I'm trans or even really butch or anything. I just like the name James. Who says a femme lesbian can't be a tomboy or something? My moms have the opposite feeling about Nick than her parents have about me. See, thing is, my moms are afraid I'll turn out straight, but I'm afraid that they're the kind of idiots who call themselves feminists who don't like trans girls, which isn't fair of me to assume because I've never said anything about it. Maybe they're open-minded. Either way, Nick and I haven't told them yet that she's a girl. They're grateful Nick kept me from failing 12th grade. And 11th grade, and 10th grade, and actually I did okay in 9th grade, but also Nick kept me from failing 8th grade. They just wish I wouldn't spend so much time with her because they don't trust boys. The important thing is that Nick is able to get permission to meet up with me, but sometimes I have to lie to get out of the house to go see her. Especially when my plan was to go see her and then commit an unknown number of felonies that are probably technically eco-terrorism. So I told my parents I was off to astronomy club and I went out the door and then around the block where Nick met me with her dad's beat-up Focus and we were off to the forest. To what used to be the forest. The clear cut. We were off to the clear cut. When we were younger, we walked there. Walking is for chumps. We had a car now. Sometimes. You have tools? I asked. She put her finger to her lips and handed me a purse. Shoplifting bag, lined with lots of foil between the fabric to keep alarm tags from going off. I opened it. Her phone was in it. I put mine inside too. Faraday works for cell phones too, she said. Can't have anyone listening in. You gonna line your cloak with tinfoil too? I thought about it, she said, not catching the joke. But I don't wear it when I go stealing anyway. Too conspicuous. There was no version of Nick that wasn't conspicuous, with or without a cloak. You have tools, I asked once again, once the purse was closed and safely in the glove box. I have tools, she said. She didn't elaborate. All I had was a telescope and some breath mints, so I figured whatever she had was better than that. What do you think they're building? Nick asked. Anytime anyone is pointlessly destructive, they're building a golf course, I said. Last year in Social Justice Club, we'd watched a film about the Oka crisis in Canada when Mohawks had stood down the Canadian army defending their land against a fucking golf course. That image had stuck with me longer than Social Justice Club stuck around. A couple of seniors had tried to change our name to the Young Anarchists of America, or YAH! But the school had vetoed that, and this kid named Beth threw a brick through the principal's office while he was inside of it, and she got expelled, and there went the club. There was some kind of lesson in that story about the nature of power and the efficacy of various methods of challenging it, but mostly my takeaway was don't get caught. Which was why we were going to fuck up this golf course at night, with masks on, like smart girls. I bet it's a housing development, Nick said. Oh, maybe a wild horse slaughterhouse. You just want to burn down a wild horse slaughterhouse. What teenage girl obsessed with Lisa Frank and ponies doesn't want to burn down a wild horse slaughterhouse? Anyway, they made horse meat illegal to sell in the U.S. They still ship it to Canada. There was no music behind our bantering. We called it the Diamond Truce. When we were 14, we always fought over control of the YouTube, and I played Marina and the Diamonds, and Nick played King Diamond, and we both hated each other's taste, and we finally decided if we were going to be friends, we couldn't listen to music together. We parked on a logging road about a quarter mile away from the edge of the clear cut. Nick pulled out two pairs of thick woolen socks, and we put them on over our shoes to conceal our prints. And we put on ski masks, which, let me tell you, always makes you feel important. Nick grabbed a duffel bag and threw it over her shoulder, grunting with the effort. I left my telescope on the passenger seat. Crime always makes you feel like a badass. It's pretty cool, as long as you commit crimes that are okay, like stealing from chain stores or from your place of employment. My moms got married before it was legal, so they should understand that law and ethics are completely separate topics. But they weren't happy when I tried to explain that to them after I'd gotten caught with a couple hundred dollars in underwear when I was 15. Whatever. Ski masks make you feel badass, but they're also kind of annoying to breathe through. I forgot about that. I hadn't had much cause to wear them in my life. In the distance, I heard deer barking. I love the sound of barking deer. I hope I'll never get used to it. We cut through the woods, avoiding the road, each of us taking a slightly different path so we didn't leave a trail. I hadn't liked the look of the clear cut during the day, but at night, I liked it less. During the day, it was this field of sticks and stumps, punctuated with huge mounds of even more sticks and presumably some stumps, like a giant's field of hay. Not pretty, but growing up in Oregon, you kind of get used to them. You can see them just on the edge of the beauty strips they leave along the side of the road to try to cover up the damage. At night, it was... The gibbous moon was almost full. Hey, I really was in astronomy club, but mostly we talked about astrology and annoyed the faculty advisor. And cast pale light on everything. Deep moon shadows made the whole thing high contrast. Honestly, kind of pretty in a macabre dead forest, everything's dead, let's build a golf course way. The field of death and ruin, I'd expected that. There was something else, though. Nick could sense it, too. Her posture changed. She was upright, not crouched in on herself, trying to make herself smaller. She was alert. It was movement, and it wasn't movement. Corner of your eyes only. Some of that might have been the moonlight interrupted by the swaying trees. Some of it might have been night birds or animals. Those deer I'd heard earlier. But some of it wasn't. Walking through that field felt like walking in a dream. The sticks beneath us made our footing treacherous. We weren't using flashlights for obvious crime-related reasons. Fog sat on the tree line, but everything where we were was clear and pale and almost shimmering, almost glittering. "A moon-shadowed field," Nick said. "Never to cross you, never to know you, for everything you see is not as it should be, and everything you see is as it is."
"What's that?" I asked.
"It's, goblin poetry from the Elsgon Fields trilogy. The heroes find it in a book right before they're ambushed by talking wolves."
"Cool," I said. "Cool, cool, cool. Glad I don't believe in that stuff."
Our ruined home, okay, our vacation home, sat at the far edge of the field, as did all the heavy equipment. When we made it to the middle of the field, I stopped for a moment to look at the sky.
"The stars are wrong," I told Nick.
"What?" she asked.
She looked up, but only for a moment.
"They're all wrong. We should be able to see Ursa Major at the very least, and the North Star."
"Well, there's Cygnus," Nick said, pointing to a spot behind us.
"That's not where..."
I started, but she was right. There it was, the Swan, the Northern Cross, just not. It was actually too bright, too clear, each star standing out like I was looking at a map that highlighted the constellation.
"It's not right either," I said.
"I don't know what to tell you," Nick said. She didn't like telling me I was wrong, and to be fair, I didn't blame her for that. I don't always respond the best. Nick kept walking. I didn't really know a ton about astronomy. I was mostly in the club because Annika was the president and I liked her smile. I must have gotten something wrong. But who can't find the Big Dipper? Maybe it was behind the trees? I didn't like having Cygnus looking down on me, I'll admit. If I'd brought my telescope, I could confirm it really was the Swan by looking for the double star and Albireo at its beak. Even my dinky telescope could do that. "Of course it was the Swan. Everything looks wrong by moonlight. Besides, I had crimes to commit." I hurried after Nick. No time to be nervous. Not about the stars, not about consequences. There were a handful of bulldozers and then some, I don't know what you call them, Ferngully-style tree murder machines and some other machines. They didn't look the same in the moonlight either, though to be fair, we hadn't gotten a close look during the day. They were massive. Some were on tank tread, which honestly felt right, like they were machines of war. We walked past the largest machines and stopped by the bulldozer closer to the remains of Fort Gege. "All right," Nick said, dropping her tool bag with a heavy clunk. "Let's see what we can do to these things." She pulled out a length of clear hose, I guess to siphon gas. "No fire," I said, looking over my shoulder, thinking I saw motion. "Huh?" "Whatever we do, no fire."
"Why not?"
"Because I'm scared," I said. I didn't say those words very often.
"It's too much. What if we catch the whole field or the whole forest? And I think they'll investigate harder for arson."
And what I didn't say is that I was afraid someone would see. I was afraid someone was already watching us, because it felt like someone was. "Okay," Nick said, hiding her disappointment well. "No fire." She pulled out a large monkey wrench next and a box of sugar.
"Sugar doesn't work," I said. "I read that somewhere. Dirt, just dirt in the gas tank and the oil tank. I don't know.
add dirt to its insides any way we can. Sounds good, Nick said, replacing the sugar. I saw into the bag just then. Another huge wrench, bolt cutters, a hunting rifle, a medieval mace. Goddamn, Nick was weird. M'lady, will you do the honors? I was going to complain about her calling me m'lady, but then she dropped to her knees and held out the wrench like offering her sovereign a sword, and I forgave her. Somewhere at the tree line, close by, something moved. Something big. A deer, probably. A really big deer that sort of looked human. I was seeing things. I took the wrench. It may or may not have been necessary to use the wrench to get the gas cap off the bulldozer, but it was a satisfying way to do it nonetheless. Air hissed as the cap came off. Nick had a mound of dirt held in her cupped hands and was walking towards the tank when we heard a voice.
Help me!
It was a scream, a guttural cry, a child's cry, distant and thin, and echoey, like through a tin can telephone, like from inside the... Did that just come from the gas tank? I think Nick said it. Maybe I said it.
Help me!
I put my ear to the tank and heard it clearer. How the fuck? I said. Who the fuck? Nick said. What the fuck? I said.
Help me,
the gas tank said. I looked at Nick and she dropped the dirt. How do we... Nick started to ask. The shadow came out from the tree line then, and it wasn't a deer. It got bigger, and it walked like a man, but it was taller than a man, and its silhouette was broken and odd, like light was coming through, like it was pierced with pins of light, and Nick saw it too, and we met eyes, and hers were as full of fear as mine, I'm pretty sure. We'll come back for you, I shouted into the gas tank. I promise. We ran. Nick stumbled. I helped her up. More figures. More giants of starlight came lumbering from the dark. When they passed into moonlight, they were invisible. Then they'd step into shadows and reappear. We ran and we ran and we didn't stop running until we were at the car and Nick drove like a madwoman, fueled with fear, blowing through fields and stop signs and red lights and didn't stop even when we almost T-boned a Subaru. And she didn't stop until we were around the corner from my house and then she stopped. She started crying. She never let me hold her, usually. I put my arm around her, and she unbuckled her seatbelt and collapsed against me, and I held her, and she cried and cried. It was good that she was crying, because otherwise I would have had to do it. She was crying for both of us. I failed, she said after a while. What? I had a rifle. I had a mace. I promised myself a long time ago that I'd be noble, that if the world called on me, that I'd answer, whatever the cost. And I failed. You ran from star giants, I said. That doesn't speak poorly of your character. I failed, she said again, but softer this time. There's a kid inside the machine right now. We'll get them out, I said. All of them. Being noble doesn't mean being dumb. One rifle versus a dozen creatures that shouldn't exist?
Cygnus, watch over us, she whispered. This realm and another. Cygnus, watch over us. The cross, the swan. She rules every summer sky.
Is that more goblin poetry? I asked. No, she said. It's something I saw carved into one of the old science desks at school last year. It's why I know the constellation. Well, that's fucking creepy, I said. We saw star giants tonight, she offered as a counterpoint. She wasn't crying anymore, but she was still nestled with her head up against my collar. It felt right, having her there. Not that I had a crush on her or anything. Fair enough, I said. You promised you'd get them out, she said. Did you mean it? Shit, I said. I guess I did say that. I guess I have to mean it now. Maybe it's safe during the day? They seem like nocturnal things. Tomorrow's Sunday. Maybe no workers either. We try again in the morning. Different tools, probably. Hacksaw? How the hell do you cut open a gas tank with a kid inside? Can't use an angle grinder. I forgot the tools, Nick said. I forgot my dad's rifle. He's gonna kill me when he finds out I took it. We'll go first thing in the morning, I said. Hacksaws, chisels, hammers. My mom's got that stuff. We'll figure it out. Okay, Nick said. She sat back upright, put her hands on the wheel, and took a deep breath. Okay, it's gonna be okay. She was talking to herself as much as she was talking to me. I wish you could spend the night, to be honest, I said. I hope that comes across how I mean it. I didn't know how I meant it. Yeah, she said. Me too. What a fucking night, I said. What a fucking night. I got out of the car and took my telescope. I was around the corner and almost home before I heard her drive off. I looked up, and the stars were in the right place. There was the Big Dipper. There was the North Star. There was Cygnus. I didn't sleep well, which was reasonably predictable. A couple hours, maybe. The best, not best, part was the sleep paralysis dream where a swan, okay, more like a goose, sat on my chest and stared at me for a brief eternity. I got up as soon as the first glint of daylight crept through the window. I didn't want to get up. I didn't want to start my day. I didn't want to get dressed, eat breakfast, and walk the couple miles out to the field. I didn't want to face down angry demons or even angry loggers. I didn't want to explain what the rifle in the bag was doing there next to the pipe wrench to anyone who might be there. I didn't want to hear that voice again. I didn't want to keep my promise. So I just didn't let myself have a choice in the matter. And I got up and I got dressed. I grabbed some Pop-Tarts, 2 packs for me, 2 packs for Nick. I grabbed a bunch of my mom's tools and I threw them into my backpack. I went out the door before my parents were even awake. I left a note on the whiteboard. Off to the woods with Nick. Be back by dinner. The be back part was really the only potential lie. Arrested girls aren't home by dinner. Dead girls don't come back at all. Nick was arguing with her mom about something when I walked up, and when she saw me, she turned her back on the conversation and hurried over. Hi, Mom! She shouted. And we walked down to the cul-de-sac where the trail started that cut along the creek, and then the ravine, and then the logging road, and then Fort Gege, or I guess a field that somehow both is and isn't in this world. We tried small talk for a moment, but Nick and I, we've always been more big subject kinds of talkers together. That morning, neither of us was trying to broach any big subjects. We dropped the thread soon enough and walked in silence. We got lucky, if anything could feel like luck just then, and either we beat the crew to work or no one was there. Who drove these things? Regular humans? Star giants? We didn't dare walk across the barren field. The sun was out and hot, and it was just too exposed. We circled around instead, through the edge of the forest. An edge forest is supposed to be dense with undergrowth and brambles and shit. It's like a skin around the muscle of the woods. Walking the edge of a clear cut is gross and weird because it's like walking through the middle of a forest instead, and it shouldn't be. I couldn't wait for the whole thing to scab over. There was no sign of celestial beings anywhere. We really did see those things, didn't we? I asked when we were almost to the bulldozers. The creatures? I don't know, Nick said. You know me. I want to believe, like the poster my mom has in her office. But I keep running over it in my head, and joint hallucination, mutably reinforced, seems a lot more plausible than whatever that was. But the voice in the bulldozer, I said. It was so clear. I didn't get as good of a listen, Nick said. I believe you, though. Like, I believe you as much as I believe myself, or whatever. Guess we'll find out either way, I said, stepping out from the forest. The sun felt good on my face, like it always does before it starts feeling not so good. Everything good is like that. Guess we will. Nick didn't let the sun touch her face, not if she could help it. Since it was too hot out for a cloak, she had on a wide-brimmed black hat. She thought it made her look like Lydia from Beetlejuice, and who was I to tell her she was wrong? In the daytime, the machines were just bulldozers. And Fern Gully forest murder machines. Just machines. That was obvious. The sun burns up magic like it burns skin, like it fades clothes, like it kills germs. Nick grabbed the duffel bag, and I went to the gas tank, which was still open.
Help me!
I guess the sun didn't get inside the gas tank to kill that magic. Heard it that time, Nick said. You keep watch? I asked. Nick always wanted to keep watch. She's good at posing dramatically, and you need that in someone keeping watch.
I'll keep watch.
I put a chisel up against the plate steel of the gas tank and swung a hammer.
It takes a really, really long time to disassemble a bulldozer with a chisel.
The sun was high overhead, and Nick was out of water, and I hadn't bothered to bring any, and I was sweating like a madwoman, swinging that hammer like John Henry, and I was pretty sure, like John Henry, that, one, I was going to beat the machine, and two, it was going to be the death of me. Nick took her turn too, but didn't have the endurance for it like I did. So I was the one with chisel and hammer in hand when the gas tank finally fell off. And I was the one with a chisel and hammer in hand who finally got a hole in that damn thing. As soon as I cracked the tank the tiniest bit, two hands broke out from inside like a lizard breaking out of its shell. Those hands ripped the tank open. Having spent the past 6 hours beating at that thing with a hammer, I had a pretty good idea how tough it was. A kid climbed out, like a middle schooler, wearing a tank top and shorts, like any kid in the neighborhood. Covered in, I guess, motor oil by the smell? Not diesel or gas. Motor oil. Thanks, he mumbled, looking at his feet. He was shy. What the fuck is happening? I asked Nick. A kid just hatched out of a gas tank as a fully formed normie, Nick answered. Just checking. Hi, I said to the kid who apparently wasn't a figment of my imagination after all. I'm James. This is Nick. The kid whirled around, taking in the scene. Oh my gosh, the kid yelled. He ran over to the closest machine, I don't know what the fuck to call it. Tractor? It had like a scoop on it and wheels? Well, it did at first. This kid ripped through the machine with his bare hands until he reached the gas tank. The tank hit the ground and another kid ripped it open from the inside. They each went off to another machine. And you know that whole thing about grains of rice and chessboards? Well, not every 5 minutes after I poked a hole in the first tank, every machine in the field was shredded. 27 children, I counted twice, ran up to us, singing and smiling and happy and soaked in motor oil. Who? What? Before I could formulate my thoughts into a coherent sentence, the sun went out. I looked up at it. Full eclipse. No corona. The birds went silent. The bugs went silent. The world went silent. The stars came out.
Thank you, the first kid said, visibly worried. But we've got to go. You should too.
They looked thoughtful for half a moment.
You could come with us if you want,
they said to us.
What?
I asked, struggling to find words. Frankly, I was pretty disassociated. It had taken me a while, but I was getting pretty good at figuring out when I was dissociated.
Where? Into the forest, always the forest,
another kid said, their voice low and sorrowful. Into the forest to feed on berries, into the forest to fight the machines, into the forest to flee the giants, into the forest to find the swan.
First we'll replant here, the first kid elaborated. Close the way between these worlds, keep you safe, all of you safe.
A figure, a silhouette, a star giant, crept into the far edge of the field. It hadn't seen us, not yet. It was walking slow and lazy, confused, maybe drowsy.
Just now, we have to be gone, a kid said. You have to be gone.
Now that the light was gone, the children looked different. Straight on, they looked like middle schoolers. From the corner of my eye, they looked like beetles. I mean, they were upright, but their skin was glossy and mottled, and their faces went in and out between human features and insectoid. Most notable, though, antenna like horns sprouted from their heads, like every devil I'd ever seen in mythology. Worse than any devil I'd ever seen, like Black Phillip's pet bugs.
Gone now, the kid said. Decide, our home or yours?
My home, I said. Yours. She reached out a hand and a child took it, and they fled towards the woods. They were gone. The sun returned. The giant disappeared. Nick was gone. The machines were mangled beyond repair, nearly beyond recognition. We'd had our revenge. Nick was gone.
Where's Nick?
My mom asked when I walked in the door.
I thought you were hanging out with him today.
She left for her trip early.
She?
She's trans, Mom.
Oh,
my mom said. She thought for a moment.
Well, I hope she has a good trip. I hope she finds what she's looking for.
Yeah, I said. Me too. I had no idea what I'd tell her parents or cops if they ever came around. I'd figure that out later. First, though, I had a lot of reading to do. Astronomy, local legend, Cygnus. Cygnus, that fucking swan. Maybe if I found it.
Can I borrow your car tonight, Mom?
I asked.
What for?
I want to go look at the stars.
And we're back. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. Would you like to introduce yourself with your name, pronouns, and just a little bit about what you do in the world or anything that you want to tell us?
Sure. I'm Margaret Killjoy. I use she and they pronouns. And I'm, well, you probably figured out that I'm an author. I'm a podcaster for work, which is, I have stress dreams. I've actually only had it once, but I had a stress dream where I was at a party and someone asked what I did for a living and I had to tell them podcaster. And I was deeply ashamed. And I do other things that I'm actually not ashamed of podcasting. It's just funny. I'm in a bunch of bands. I mostly write. That's what I do. I live in on a mountain and write.
Yeah. I mean, all of these were my childhood aspirations were to be a crone that lives on a mountain and writes or make things. So thank you for living my dream, at least, you know.
I actually have to hold on to that romanticization sometimes when I'm like, why haven't I talked with anyone besides my dog in a week? And I'm like, I'm living the dream. I'm living the dream.
Yeah, the thing we all dreamt of as kids, all of us, everyone that's listening to this.
You know, I bet it's a decent chunk of our audience.
It probably is, you know, in some form or another. You will appreciate this anecdote about podcasting. I was in a car taking some, like, a day off for the first time in a very long time recently. And
You were slacking in a car.
I was slacking in a car. But I was going over like hyperfixating on things that I had just researched for Live Like the World is Dying. And I was talking about them to the people in the car. And these are two people that you're both friends with as well. Or sorry, that you are friends with both of them as well.
Yeah.
And I just had a moment where I stopped mid-sentence and I was like, I'm doing a Margaret right now. And they were like, yeah.
Hyperfixated on what you're researching.
Yeah. And then in my downtime, air quotes,
that being the only thing
I can talk about.
Yeah. No, I have some friends who call me every now and then and they're like, how's it going? And then I just tell them about something that happened in the 19th century that I'm in the middle of reading two books about.
You know, living.
I still call. So I'm clearly not failing entirely.
Living the dream.
Yeah.
Speaking of dreams, this is actually not a segue into anything. So we just listened to your story, A Field, a Shadow, Indeed a Shadow. And even though the listeners just listened to it, in your own words, could you just tell us what is the story about? What did we just listen to?
Oh, this is one of the more abstract stories that I've ever successfully gotten published. It does not have there is a plot in that there are characters and they have a problem and they go out and solve that problem. But it is not a story with a traditional story arc or whatever, right? I'm not trying to be like, I'm so original. It's actually like, it was a deviation from the way that I often write stories and kind of an experiment to see whether or not I could do it in a way that made me happy. And so, you know, the fact that you refer to this as like, you know, you segued in with a dream, I tried to write with a little bit more dream logic than I usually do. And I really enjoyed writing that way. This is a story about what kinds of reality we choose to live in when we choose to take direct action. This is a story about how I spend a not insubstantial amount of my time thinking about being abducted by fairies.
Worthwhile pursuit of thought.
Yeah. And how, you know, when I was a kid, that was like all the books that I read that I loved were portal fantasies, you know, where you start off in normal world and then you end up in the crazy land of crazy wildness or whatever, right? And so I wanted to write something that touched on that. Obviously, the protagonist chooses not to go through this portal at the end of it. And the secondary character does. And their way to discovering that other world is through felonious direct action. And it's interesting that I don't know exactly when this will come out, but it'll probably be around the same time as I just finished doing research on the Earth Liberation Front for my podcast, Cool People Do Cool Stuff. And, you know, I knew a little bit about them because I was an Earth First environmentalist during the Green Scare, which was the crackdown on this direct action environmental group, the Earth Liberation Front, that acted feloniously at night in like kind of clandestine actions as compared to Earth First that I was part of that did non-clandestine illegal direct action, like blockades and civil disobedience and things like that. But the two culturally overlap, right?
Yeah.
And so I was reading a lot about that, and I was thinking about how when we create these cultures that are entirely distinct from mainstream culture, you can live outside of empire. You can live outside of capitalism. You can live outside of these things for periods of time. And there's always this tension, because the only way in which people do that successfully is criminally. And so there's this tension where, you know, the state and the recuperative forces and this and that want to bring people out of that other world. And they want to bring people out of that other world in a lot of ways. The classic way is prison, right?
Yeah.
But even like people who are not necessarily doing things that would really get you thrown in prison, just jail, right? Like I've been thrown in jail a couple times for my, you know, direct action. I've never been thrown in prison because I don't commit felonies. Not that that always saves people, but it, you know, successfully saved me through being a West Coast environmentalist during the Green Scare. And then there's the like growing up aspect, right? There's kind of a, you know, it doesn't really touch on it in this particular story, but there's this sort of like Peter Pan aspect of, you know, the only way to live outside of society is to never grow up. And when I was younger, we called ourselves kids instead of punks. That was like the word we used. And I remember once I was hitchhiking.
Totally.
And I was hitchhiking and this woman who was like probably in her like mid 30s or something picked me up. And I was probably like 26 or something. And I was like, oh, us kids. And she looks at me and she's like, you're not a kid. And I was like kind of offended, you know? And then I'm like, oh, it's true. And I remember when I was a forest kid, we were like, oh, us kids, the forest kids. And this like mid 30s anarchist was like, could you stop always using that? Like, that's really alienating to those who are don't identify as children, you know? And and so there's this other force, this recuperative force, where you grow up, you grow out of being a squatter, you grow out of doing direct action, you know, and when I was young, I wanted a portal fantasy. And then I got one. I dropped out of college. I started hitchhiking, I started hopping trains, I started living outside of empire in opposition to empire, and it ruled, and it hurt, and it was traumatic, and it was beautiful. And I kept going like longer than most of the people around me, you know? And like at some point I was like in my like early or mid 30s, and I was like, how come I'm the only one who's still traveling? You know? And it was like,
yeah.
And eventually you slowly leave that space. And I don't think that's inevitable. And I think that I don't think I'm like suddenly, I mean, I have a mortgage now, you know, I like get paid money to do things and then buy stuff at stores instead of digging through the trash out back. Like in so many ways, I'm like caught up in empire, but yeah. And I think that's part of why I like long to get abducted by fairies again, or I suppose elves might be the better word in this particular context. Although that sounds sketchy when I say it out loud, but we'll keep it in.
Yeah. You don't want to be abducted by some other elves with an F, elves. Abducted by the elf.
No, I'm good. I made it through my 20s without going to prison. I have no shame on anyone who makes different decisions than me.
Yeah. I mean, it's like what you're describing is like very, I feel like it's like on a lot of people's minds, I think. But, you know, I'm obviously biased because it's on a lot of the people's minds that I know. It's like this
right.
tension between like getting older, like recognizing that there's more like having our struggles with daily life change in ways that were like, oh yeah, okay, I need to figure out how to make more money because like I have more needs, or like,
yeah,
I don't know. I feel like I'm living that tension right now in Arizona as I watch literally all of my friends become nurses, and I'm like, I can just make stuff and sell it and like be a grungy punk still, right?
And I mean, like, yes.
Yeah.
You know?
I hope.
It's sometimes harder, but there's ways to do it. And like, you know, I make my living by creating things and I'm very grateful. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love my friends who are nurses and I love my, you know, like we're all going to handle things, do things in different ways, the things that we're drawn to. But, you know, I do think that there are ways to, well, that's getting a little off topic.
Yeah. Just to kind of circle back to this, one of the reasons that I loved reading this story is because it grapples with a lot of things that I was really fascinated with as a kid, which are, you know, like I had my version of a portal fantasy, or like I had my version of like wandering around the small strip of woods in the suburbs that I grew up in, and like building weird little forts. I had a fort that I built, but then there was this other fort that the neighborhood kids built, and they hated me. I had no friend. I had no friends when I was a kid.
Rough.
But they had a much cooler fort than my fort, but I had a secret fort. And yeah, I don't know. I get really fascinated with the stories and the worlds that we create when we're kids.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, what was your portal fantasy? Like what were the worlds that you wandered as a smaller person?
Yeah.
Younger person.
So I got really lucky in that in elementary school, I had a really solid group of three or four friends, and we were like a very Stranger Things or Freaks and Geeks, whatever crowd, you know, where I started playing Dungeons and Dragons when I was in fourth grade. And yeah, we'd run around in the woods with sticks and sword fight, and we'd read Vampire the Masquerade books that were way too adult for us and not really understand what's happening in them. And, you know, I had that. And then my two best friends moved. And I went into middle school with a much smaller friend group, and my life became substantially worse. But I just read fantasy books. I read some science fiction, but I just read fantasy books. And I also read role playing game books without playing. In fourth and fifth grade, I played a ton of D&D, and then I didn't. For years. It was near the end of high school when I started playing again because I had friends I could talk into it. So I just spent all my allowance and everything on second edition D&D books and a little bit Magic the Gathering cards, but then you have to like play with people. And also I'm also just like I don't actually really like competitive games. You know this about me, you're my dungeon master. And I don't know. That was kind of it. Similar thing, run around in the woods of the suburbs and find the holes in reality and crawl into them, which are often look like storm drains, and I almost drowned once.
Yeah, I crawled through a lot of literal holes as a kid in the woods.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I don't know. It's like, I remember when they built a new school near my neighborhood, and like
kids just hate construction sites.
Kids hate
it's just a natural sites. Instinct. Yep.
Yeah.
We can leave it there. It's fine.
But I don't know. Yeah, it's like these worlds are really important, I think, as younger people. And then like also as older people. Like, I don't know. I feel like we have those waves of the, like, we have these fantasies in adolescence, and then we grow up some, and some of that is letting go of that. But I feel like a lot of times, eventually, we come back to it. And
yeah,
I don't know. It's just a really beautiful process, I think. And this is a weird question that I really like to ask people. I've never asked it on the show before, I don't think. But how would 11-year-old Margaret judge current Margaret? Or what would 11-year-old Margaret mm-hmm. think of current Margaret?
11-year-old Margaret would be fucking stoked. She'd be a little bit confused by several important components, like the name Margaret. Uh-huh. But considering, well, what's fourth grade? I'm like a, whatever normal is, I'm a year younger than that. Like when I was like 9 or 10, I tried to change my name to Kelly. And then I was like, you know what? I am already getting beaten up almost every single day. I am not changing my name to a girl's name. So I think I'd be all right with that part. I would be stoked. I'd probably be a little bit more excited about, no, I don't know. I think 11-year-old me would be very excited about 20-year-old me, and we'd be very excited about 40-year-old me in different ways. You know, 40-year-old me is a writer, is a professional writer. 20-year-old me was living a fantasy world, you know, was out living adventures on a daily basis. Turns out adventure is just another word for bad stuff happens. But, you know, it was fun at the time. Yeah. I think about it every now and then. I once wrote for some zine. I once wrote a like letter to child me. And, I wrote a letter to like baby anarchist me when I was like 19. Aww. And it was kind of like, hey, you're on the right path. Not everything's as black and white as you think. But when I was 11, I hadn't fallen into ideology yet. So I was like free of that particular black and white thinking.
Yeah. Aw. I hope it was a sweet letter.
Yeah. It wasn't yelling at me. I have a lot of sympathy for me. Someone's got to. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did some dumb stuff that I'm not sorry for. I sometimes wonder why I'm not sorry for certain things that I've done. And then I'm like, whatever. I forgive myself.
You know, someone has to forgive us for the silly things we do.
You know, there's a whole structure about that, but that's religion.
That's true. That's true. As kind of a transition, I wanted to ask you a little bit about writing queer YA.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, would you consider the story YA? I guess when I read it, I was like, this is totally YA, but I don't know if that's true.
I mean, it's functionally YA. It almost like doesn't need to be categorized because it was not sold on its own.
Totally.
You know? You've actually read, Inman was the first reader of, not the literal first, actually maybe, of a book that I have coming out this year that is a crossover, which means YA, but you know that it's mostly adults who are going to read it.
Yeah.
Trans book. But yeah, I mean, this is functionally YA. Like overall, you kind of presume that the audience of a story is about a year or two younger than your protagonist. That mm-hmm. is the like quick rule of thumb in writing. If I were to write this out longer, this would absolutely be a YA, and it'd be really weird because you'd be following the character who's not in the portal world.
Yeah, yeah.
Or this would be the intro, and then it would cut over to the portal world, and we'd follow, I don't remember my characters' names.
Nick and James. Nick goes through the portal.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Like, why is really wacky, and it's a genre that I truly love. I feel like I've had some letdowns in YA, like over my lifetime, like probably mm-hmm. most people who read YA. But
Is that the Rawling equation? The Rawling consideration?
No,
the
I mean...
The great letdown of his literary history.
Yes, that is a great letdown. But no, actually, it's Garth Nix, the Old Kingdom series.
Oh, I've never actually read it. I started it once. It was so weird.
It's so weird. It's about a teenage necromancer.
Yeah.
Who...
Isn't there, way too much sex in it or something?
I mean,
that's not inherently bad, but...
remember.
Okay. Anyway, yeah. I tried to read it kind of recently. Anyway, sorry. Please continue.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, I don't know. It gets a little bit adult. Sabriel, the main character in the first book, is, I think, 18 when the book starts.
Okay.
Which is maybe a funny age for a YA protagonist. Or maybe a great age. But then in the second book, it switches to a different character, Lyriel. And Lyriel is so cool. She lives in a hollowed out glacier with a bunch of queer women and gender nonconforming people who can see the future.
Cool.
And she is the outsider because she cannot see the future. And so she lives in a library.
Whoa.
And hangs out with a weird magical dog and finds a magic sword and uncovers strange tomes not seen in 1,000 years. And I'm going to say some spoilers, but these books are so old. So if you haven't read them, you're forewarned. And then Lyriel is fronting really hard as queer, there's this boy who's interested in her and she's dear God, stop flirting with me. Get away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the series.
Oh, they get together.
No, because they're related, but unbeknownst to either of them at the time.
The Star Wars effect.
Yeah, the Star Wars effect. But she does eventually, out of nowhere, get into a heterosexual marriage, and it's really disappointing.
It happens to the best of them.
Yeah, yeah. Mary Louise Alcott would be very disappointed about it. But
I don't know who that is.
The person who wrote Little Women, who...
Oh,
God, yeah.
I do... Who was a man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And who... They wouldn't publish that person's book because they didn't want the main character to get married at the end, but in order to publish it, had to have them get married.
Yeah.
I feel like this was eventually going to be a question, but it was really just...
It was something about writing YA, queer YA.
Yeah. What?
How do?
How, yeah.
What mean?
How do write queer YA, and what are your feelings about what, I don't want to say should, but what would you like to see more in queer YA?
You know, I clearly write queer characters as a conscious choice. But it's only a half conscious choice. I'm just I just write me and my friends and you know, and some people are straight, some people are not, some people are this, some people are that, you know, and this one reason I love the word queer, right, is it's the sort of not your business, the details, unless we might fuck version of it, you know? I don't know how to identify my sexuality and I just go with queer and it's fine with me, you know? But you know, when I wrote the Danielle Kane books, there's two books in this series, two novellas, and they found their audience because they were queer horror. And I set out neither to write horror nor queer.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote my friends dealing. Okay, yes, there's a blood red deer that eviscerates someone at the end of the first chapter. But I get why it's horror. All right, you know. But I don't even know how to pronounce horror, so I can't write it. And because everyone makes fun of me for my accent. It's the only word I have an accent for. I mean, I have a minor accent otherwise, but it's that word. Anyway, I just wrote, because I think if you stick magic in the real world, you get horror.
Totally.
There's just not really a way around that. unless you're just replicating technology. And if you were to really honestly write about technology, you'd be writing horror because you'd be writing the kid that Ursula Le Guin condemned to live in horror.
That's locked away from, yeah.
Yeah, like because in the real world, technology is constructed out of the destruction of the existent. You know, I don't know if it has to be, but it certainly is the way it is. And so I wrote horror without really planning to. And queer, for me, is the same way. I just wrote my characters into it. I thought I was writing a slightly over-the-top anarchist propaganda novella. And instead, it's like resonates specifically as queer literature. And that's fine by me. I love it. You know, so I didn't set out. That would be my advice, I guess, is just write you and your friends and the people that you care about and whatever that looks like. And it, you know, and that way it'll feel more real than if you're like if you're listening and you're, a straight woman in a heterosexual monogamous relationship and you've never had any attraction towards, you know, women, you don't have to write. I mean, you could write some gay characters, but don't like write about their struggle or something. You don't have to. I'm not really a big, like, I think that writers should have a little bit more freedom than we sometimes allow. But, you know, I'm not trying to like tell people not to. But I guess what I'm saying is it's like, write the people that you want to see on the page. And I wanted to see, I end up writing a lot of unrequited youthful crushes. And I end up writing a lot of demisexual and asexual characters. I don't quite identify with those, but I'm not the furthest thing from some of those things. And I write them because I like, to me, it feels like more realistic than this weird, I hate the way, okay, here's what it actually gets down to. I hate the way that romance happens in traditional storytelling.
Totally.
It's boring. And one of the things that queers it, I mean, yeah, you can like just have it be gay girls and then hooray, it's queer. And that's cool too.
Yeah.
But it's one thing that really fucks with it is when one of the people doesn't experience romantic or sexual attraction as much or is just hung up on someone else or like, you know, like.
Yeah.
Like I want to write about the 60-year-old spinsters where they've been sort of wanting to date their entire lives, but they've just had completely different lives. And then they never do. And they grow old together platonically, but they've been in love the whole time, you know, because that's like, that's fucking real. Mm-hmm. And so I think that these two characters whose names I totally know have that experience. And that is that is the experience that interests me. That's my rant.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for the rant. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know. I was talking to someone about this the other day about we were discussing like kind of like YA like media, mostly in television. And we were discussing kind of the differences between two shows that we had both watched, one of which was like, let's have queer characters experiencing the most stereotypical normie bullshit ever.
Yeah.
And one of them was like, let's have a lot of queer characters experiencing like things that are relevant to their actual lives and like are actually like queering these relationships.
Yeah. And I would love to see things that have heterosexual people doing that, you
know,
because I think that, I mean, when you get galaxy brained enough, it doesn't matter anymore. Like, heterosexuality is a perfectly valid sexual orientation for someone to have if they want, you know? But also, it's like, but it also doesn't really exist, you know? And that's the nice thing about being a non-passing trans woman is that I just like exist to wrecking ball people's concept of themselves as heterosexual. Or I did when I was younger. Now I just live in a mountain by myself. But, and like, I don't know. I think that it would be useful for people because one of the other problems with traditional heterosexual patriarchal relations or whatever, it's not just about who's attracted to whom and who they fuck. It's about the power relations involved in that. And so it would be very useful. Like, I think cheating is fucked up, right? I also understand why marriage is also fucked up or can be fucked up. But, like, I think cheating is fucked up. And I think that people wouldn't cheat as much if they understood, not even just, like, polyamory. That's not necessarily the solution to everything. The solution to a lot of complicated romance movie plots. but it being able to understand that love and relationships can look like so many different things would absolutely heal so many relationships. And I think that seeing that expressed in fiction is one of the good ways to do it. Although I didn't actually really write this story to, like, say a thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like the thing you say, wait, can I segue into what I want to say about this story that's unrelated to your question?
Absolutely.
Okay. This is one of my favorite stories. And this story comes out of this place where I have passed a threshold as a writer where I've gone past a certain amount of gatekeeping where I every now and then can kind of wild out and just do whatever I want and write a non-story. This is like kind of a non-story, you know? It doesn't follow certain arcs, and it kind of cuts off at an interesting place. And if I were less good of a writer, less experienced of a writer, I would say it cuts off at an awkward place. And not to, like, toot my own horn, it's not the best story in the world or whatever, but I'm really proud of it. And I'm also proud of it because, you know, when it was first published, it was published in this anthology called Weather Change, The Revolution Will Be Weird. And so I had all this freedom because I was writing for this anthology. And it was supposed to be weird fiction. And so weird fiction is already a really fun genre because you can get away with a lot more stuff.
Yeah.
But it also felt like good that I could kind of breathe a little bit when I write this. And one of the reasons I like doing that, the story isn't totally channeled, but it is way less outlined than a lot of my stories. And the reason I like some of those stories is because I don't realize what they're about until years later. I had no idea what the story was about when I wrote it. I put in weird cryptic shit, the stars and the fucking, you know, I was like, all I knew at the start was, like, some kids were going to go elf some shit in the forest.
Yeah.
You know? And then I was like,
maybe get abducted by other elves.
Yeah. Yeah. With a V instead of an F, you know? And then I was thinking about this story a few months ago on Samhain when I was pondering the history of abducted by fairies, you know, concepts. And I was thinking about it in relation to some of the other stuff I've written. And that was when I realized that I was writing about in childhood how we want so desperately to leave these normal lives. And it's like, it's not even like symbolism. It's like in the text. It's not, it's like,
yeah,
not even really subtext, you know?
No.
But I didn't quite know it. And like my favorite example of this kind of channeling, this story never got published. I wrote it when I was just like not quite good enough yet. But I wrote this story a while ago where there's this like, and I was not out as trans, where there's this trans, even to myself, there's this trans girl who goes to Amsterdam and like plays accordion on the streets and like falls in love with this skinhead boy. And then they like are on other planets fighting giant bugs because anarchists invented portals to other planets or whatever. And they have like a bunch of kids together and shit. And I finished writing this story and I was like, oh man, I have no idea if this guy listens to this podcast. I was like, oh, fuck, I have a crush on my friend Sjord. And, like, I had no idea. Like, because I lived in Amsterdam and played accordion on the streets. And there was this, like, big, tough skinhead dude who was, you know, anti-fascist skinhead, obviously. Who, you know, his hobbies were playing D&D and fighting Nazis and listening to hip-hop and lifting weights. And, like, and he was always, like, taking care of me and all the other, like, kind of more femme people. I had a beard, like I was not out as femme, but I was like, and
femmes can have beards.
Yeah, no, totally, but less often read that way. And And like, and this was 20 years ago, you know, not the story, but the living in Amsterdam. Oh God, it was literally 20 years ago now.
Totally.
And I had no idea that I had a crush on him because it was completely outside the context of, I very rarely have crushes on cis men. It's not really within my usual attraction pattern. So I didn't notice when it happened. And then it came out in this story and I have no idea. And I wasn't thinking about it. And I love that. That is the magic of writing, which is interesting because overall, I think people get better at writing by doing less automatic writing and more plotting and more structure. I think that is the way to become a better writer. And it shows that that previous story wasn't good enough yet, you know? But A Field, a Shadow, Indeed, a Shadow. I, again, not to be arrogant, there's very few things that I'm like, I'm a dabbler. I'm like a professional dabbler. I make jewelry. I do carpentry. I built a shitty A-frame in the woods. I, you know, and I'm like real mediocre at all the things I do. And I'm not ashamed of that. I specifically consciously believe that I should be regularly doing things I'm bad at as a way to keep my brain plastic. I think I'm an okay writer. That's like the one thing I can be like, you know, I put in the fucking work.
I think most people would agree that you're a very fantastic writer, Margaret.
Thanks.
I just have two little more things I want to ask you about. Before we segue into the word of the month, which I've got, it's going to be a good one. I'm so glad.
Yeah, it's crenellations, isn't it?
It's crenellations. So
I'm just trying to guess what the word of the month is.
I was going to ask you to guess, so this works.
All right. My first guess is crenellations.
Great. Great. All will be revealed soon.
Okay.
So just because I love being able to ask the authors directly about random details in their stories that they probably just made up like on the fly. So the Elscon Fields trilogy, it's made up, right?
My favorite thing in the world is to like I like leave little hooks for myself, you know, where I'm like, oh, maybe one day. I love putting fiction in my fiction. It's so much
totally
fun.
Hell yeah. So, you know, Samuel Delaney made up a fake relationship between two archaeologists corresponding about a fake archaeological find in the appendices of a fantasy novel as the base for the fantasy novel. And like, this was in the 70s when no one could Wikipedia shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. What is the Elscon Fields trilogy about?
Oh, I don't know yet. I haven't written it yet.
Okay, great.
Maybe that would be the way I expand out this universe is just write the Elscon Fields trilogy.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Great. And then the other, this isn't really a question, but it's more like a line that I really want to just bring to the forefront, which is like we have this tension between there's multiple tensions going on in the story. And like one of those tensions is, you know, our home or your home, the like go through the portal or stay. And then the other tension is how we take action and how we respond to the call to adventure. And this line that you wrote is like, this is how 11-year-old Inman would judge current Inman. This is the standard. And I just really loved seeing it. I had a rifle. I had a mace. I promised myself a long time ago that I'd be noble, that if the world called on me, that I'd answer, whatever the cost. And I failed. And that's the standard by which 11-year-old Inman would judge current Inman.
Yeah.
And I just loved that line. This is not a question. This is just me saying I loved that line.
Thanks. No, the fact that they have a fantasy weapon with them is like... I hadn't even, yeah, no, God, I feel like I'm the last person in the world to understand what this story is about, you know? I'm like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Well, any last things you want to say about this story before we move into the end of the things, the end of things?
No, I don't think so.
Cool. Any, to ask you your own question, any questions that I didn't ask you that you wish that I had asked you?
Oh, I already did the thing where I interjected the thing.
Oh, yeah.
Unconscious writing. Right. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
cool. Do you have anything that you want to plug, and where can people find you on social media? Can you talk about your YA book? It's okay if you can't.
No, it's funny. I like can't remember. I every time I talk to the editor, it's coming out this fall from Feminist Press. It is going to be kickstarted in a couple of months. And it is the first book in a trilogy. The first book is called The Sapling Cage. And I can't remember. Every single time I talk to my editor, I'm like, what am I allowed to say about it yet before the big announcement? And every time I get an answer, and then I'm like, I'm going to remember the answer this time. but remembering things has never been one of my superpowers. So I have a book called The Sapling Cage. It's coming out as a queer crossover, which means it's a YA book, but admitting that most people read it are going to be adults. And I'm really excited about it. It is, in many ways, my debut novel. I've been writing for a very long time, but I primarily write in the novella format. And the only novels that I've written and published are ghost-written, trashy heterosexual romance that I will never tell you because I signed an NDA. And also, I'm not ashamed of them, but I wouldn't put my name on them if I had a choice.
Totally, totally.
Oh, and then the thing I want to plug is that I do have a new book out. It is a role-playing game that I wrote all by myself.
Completely.
Called Penumbra City, that didn't involve years and years of work by Inman. Me and Inman and our friend Robin, and with a lot of help from some other people, put together a game world called Penumbra City, which is a tabletop role-playing game that you've probably heard about if you're listening to this show, but if you haven't, you should check it out. It's called Penumbra City, and it just came out.
Yeah, you can find it on tangledwilderness.org, and you can go download the PDF of it right now. You can play it today.
Yeah.
So go out and play it.
If you read fast. I read really fast when I was a kid. I slowed down at some point.
Yeah, me too.
Brain plasticity.
Woo! Okay. So this is one of my favorite parts of the show is
when you talk about crenellations.
When I talk about crenellations, when I get to be a fucking etymology nerd.
Okay, what's our word?
Yeah, any more guesses besides crenellations? You've said it today.
I've said a lot of words today.
I know.
Portal fantasy. I don't think portal. It's portal fantasy. I didn't say the word liminal, which is good.
That is
fuck
a good
that
one.
Word. Oh, no, no, I was saying fuck that word. It's overdone. Yeah. No, I love liminal shit.
Anyone ever call you any names as a kid?
Most of them I don't want to say on mic.
Yeah, no, that's reasonable. Any adjectives that one might
was it when I said crazy
to?
Earlier I said crazy, and then I was like, oh, I try not to say that so much anymore. No, I don't know. I give up.
Okay. It's like one of the first words in the story. Weird.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Weird fiction. Yeah.
Weird fiction. What do you, so we probably all know what the word weird means to us as in our current world. What do you think the origins of the word weird are? Any guesses?
I bet it's like the word thing. I bet it's like one of those like Germanic. Oh, I feel like I've heard this before, but just tell me. I'm so excited. Wait. Hold on. Because it's like weird women is like a thing that like people used to say before weird meant the way that we say weird now.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like wise or something?
Sort of. Yeah,
okay,
close.
Okay.
Very close.
What do we got?
Okay, so Weird comes from an old English word, literally weird, but spelled W-Y-R-D. And it means fate, chance, fortune, and destiny.
Hell yeah.
Or literally that which comes from the Proto-Germanic word that I cannot pronounce, word his. It also comes from an Old Norse word, uter, which means, again, fate. And then from some little pieces of words, wort, which means to turn or wind. And then also the German word wurden and the Old English word wurdon, or to become. So were to turn, bend, and also becoming.
That rules.
And yeah, no, it's a cool fucking word. And it, you know, in how like Greek tragedies and mythology, there's these characters called the Fates.
Yeah. Is that the Weird Sisters or something?
Yeah. So the Fates in, you know, like English, European, whatever, et cetera, words, like mythology or fantasy, folklore, whatever, the Fates were turned into the Weird Sisters or the Weird Women, because of it literally meant fate. So it's literally just like the Old English or Germanic word for the Fates is the weird women or Weird Sisters.
That rules.
Yeah. And we start to see, and the, you know, there's obviously a lot of history behind this, but it's like we see depictions of these people, like in the Chronicles by someone's name that I can't remember. What is this person's name? Oh God, I forgot. There's this Scots. This Scots writer named like Hollinsfield or something who wrote this series called The Chronicle, and it's about the Chronicles. And it's about the actual historical life of Macbeth. And then Shakespeare used that. See, we're getting into Shakespeare, of course. Of course I'm gonna reference Shakespeare. And Shakespeare took that to form like the characters, the witches or the Weird Sisters in Macbeth. And
whoa. Okay.
And this
God
is
damn it, do we say weird because of Shakespeare? Is that where you're going?
Yeah, but not really because of Shakespeare, because of King James. King James.
Oh, even worse.
Yeah.
Well, I like Shakespeare and I hate King James.
With good reason.
Fuck him. The only proof that identity alone, you can be as gay as you want and be evil.
Yeah. So King James was an avid witch hunter and commissioned Macbeth to be written because he wanted a mythological ancestral connection for one of his ancestors. His ancestor is Fleance, who's like this random child in Macbeth who survives all of the conflict and turmoil of Macbeth.
Okay.
And that is King James's ancestor. So he commissioned it. He, fervent witch hunter, and this is conjecture. I believe that
reason. Sorry, go ahead.
I really believe that Shakespeare was like really pro witch and did a really sneaky thing like he did in a lot of works, which was he wrote things for two people. He wrote things for the common people and he wrote things for the nobles. And then he wrote things for three groups of people, for the weirdos. And the witches in Macbeth are like, you can read them as antagonistic or as the protagonists of the story who save the country from a tyrannical king.
That's cool. I did a bunch of research about fucking King James and the witch hunts, and like because of some podcast that I did at some point, I don't remember which episode it's in, and learning that he's the reason the witch hunts kicked off, and that prior to that, because the Catholic Church was like, no, witchcraft isn't real. Use your head. Because they were like kind of sciency at that time. And then here comes this fucking piece of shit who's just like, I swear they're real. I'm going to write 8 million books about why ivermectin will cure COVID. Because that's like that's like what it was at the time. It was like, but yeah. He was the king. So he was like influential enough to fucking, I don't like him. And also his version of the Bible sucks.
Yeah. Bad guy.
Pretty. So I understand the
appeal. And it's kind of because of him that we see the Fates, who are normally portrayed as these like very majestic and words are failing me right now, very majestic like figures, we see them transmogrified into these like, and I don't mean this, but these are words that other people mean, these like grotesque or like hideous
or
hag imagery,
is
because King James was an avid witch hunter, and so they couldn't have the Fates or the Weird Sisters like come on and be majestic looking. And
just when you think you already are mad enough at a man who's been dead since before anyone that you know has known anyone who's ever been born.
Yeah. And this is my plug for why Shakespeare did this intentionally, is he could have just called them witches. But he named them the Weird Sisters as a nod to the Fates. He took advantage of knowing about history that most people would not have.
That's cool.
The people who did know it would have seen that. And I don't know. I just really love this word. It's great. And also the way that it might have been spelled during Shakespeare's time, and I think this is the etymology of this word, is wayward.
Whoa.
So that's the word of the month.
Hell yeah. That's a good word of month for this story. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I always like to find, I've been wanting to do this one for a while, and I've just been waiting for someone to use a story that references the word weird many times and is about portal fantasies.
Yeah. And isn't weird a book about the weird. Yeah.
Totally.
Cool. Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And we'll see you, I'm sure, another time. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, then know that to be named weird is to have the power to control fate. That to be wayward is to become destiny. But you can also, if you like the podcast, support it. And you can support it by liking and rating and reviewing and subscribing. And I'm just saying words that seem like they might be right. I don't actually know how these systems work. You can do all of those things, but you can also just tell people about the show. Put it on while you're making dinner. Put it on while you're trying to digest the rules to Penumbra City. You can also support the show by supporting us financially, and you can do that by supporting our publisher, Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness. You can find us at patreon.com/strangersinatangledwilderness, and there you can sign up for our Zine of the Month Club, where you can get a zine version of the stories that we feature here sent to you every month. But you can also read along for free on our website, tangledwilderness.org. And while you're there, check out some of our other podcasts, like Live Like the World is Dying, your podcast for what feels like the end times. It's on a short break right now, but it'll be back in March. Or you can check out The Spectacle, for a podcast for people who love movies and hate cops. As part of our Patreon, we have a tier called the Acknowledgements tier, where for $20 a month, you can get us to acknowledge, shout out, or thank pretty much anything that you want us to. It could be your name, it could be an organization that you think is really cool, it could be a fictional or theoretical concept. If you pay us $20 a month, we will acknowledge and thank it on all of our podcasts. So thanks to all of these wonderful people, concepts, or organizations. Thank you, Amber, Ephemeral, Appalachian Liberation Library, Portland's Hedron Hackerspace, Boldfield, E. Patoli, Eric, Buck, Julia, Catgut, Marm, Carson, Lord Harkin, Trickster, Princess Miranda, Benben, Anonymous, Thunder, Janice and Odell, Allie, Paparuna, Milica, Boise Mutual Aid, Theo, Hunter, SJ, Paige, Nicole, David, Dana, Chelsea, Starro, Jennifer, Kirk, Chris, Micaiah, and the Eternal, Haas the Dog. Thanks so much for supporting us and making all of the things that we do possible. And lastly, a lot of the features on this podcast come from listeners like you. So if you feel like a stranger that would like to find their story a home in this tangled wilderness, consider submitting it. Maybe it will open up a portal for someone. Next month, we, as of recording this, don't know what our feature will be. So stay tuned. We hope you come back.